Hello and welcome to Season 3, Episode 12 of Logicast, the AWS News podcast brought to you by Logicarta. I'm Carl Robinson, CEO and co-founder of Logicarta, and I'm joined, as always today, by my colleague, lead cloud engineer, John Goodall. How are you doing today, John?
Mixed bag. I've still got that cold, so I sound like I've been drinking, but I promise I haven't. But I did buy a sink at the weekend, which has made me abnormally happy.
A sink?
A sink.
For the shed?
For the bathroom, I need to replace. Okay. Yeah, so the bathroom, I have a pedestal sink. So the listeners know a huge amount about my house now. This is fun. I have a pedestal sink and these god-awful tiles that you can't drill through because they're made out of concrete and I don't have any diamond tip bits. And my tap's broken. So I'd have to take the whole sink off to change the tap anyway. So I figure, well, I'll just change the sink because I hate it and it's knackered. And I'll get one on a vanity unit on a cupboard. So I don't have to worry about screwing through these tiles. So because I'm lazy and don't want to spend £15 on a drill bit, I spent £135 on a sink and a cupboard.
And have you fitted said sink and cupboard or have you bought it?
No, I've just bought it. That's job for my week off because I also need to change the isolators on the pipes and bits and pieces.
Coming soon in Season 3, Episode 13 of Logicast, John has fitted his sink. I'm sure we'll get to hear about that.
14 or 15, a couple of weeks.
No pressure fitting John. Anyway, we're not here to talk about John's sink. We are here to talk about AWS news, and we are joined today by a very special guest, Stephen Sennett, who is a fellow AWS community builder. How are you doing today, Stephen?
Very good, and unfortunately, I don't have any sinks to install, but I'm very keen to hear how that all goes.
We could get you back in a future episode to hear how it all goes.
I mean, you can say, well, you can't quite say everything in the kitchen sink, but everything in the bathroom sink, it kind of gets close.
Absolutely, yeah. That's what we talk about on the podcast. So tell us a bit about yourself, Stephen. Where are you based? What do you do for a living?
Yep, so my name's Stephen. I'm based in Melbourne, Australia. And so I'm, as was mentioned, I'm an AWS community builder. I'm now, fourth year, something like that. I don't know. Ooh. They keep on inviting me back. So, hey, you know, more fool them. But yeah, so for me, I've been working for the last year or so as an independent consultant, mainly focusing on AWS, bits of Azure and bits and pieces like that. And I'm also an instructor with acloudguru.com/Pluralsight as well. So little bits of everything here and there.
Nice.
And do they only hire Australians for Acloud Guru?
Oh, well, I mean, it's interesting. Used to be a lot of Australians in the mix, but now a bit of a mixed bag just everywhere. And again, since Pluralsight, like instructors all over the world with all kinds of specialties, it's really, really interesting stuff.
Nice.
The interesting the interesting thing with Ryan as well is you can kind of tell, like, if he's got some kind of lecture or something like that, you can tell where he's picked stuff up in the UK when he'll say, like, with the router, when you have the route to the internet. And it's like, no, it's a router. It is a router or a cache or a cache.
I'm glad you mentioned that because I can't talk about Ryan Kruneberg without mentioning the word cache because I've listened to a lot of Ryan's lectures studying for my SA associate. And yeah, the cache one always used to get me.
Hello, cloud guru.
Is that a common pronunciation of cache in Australia, or is that just specific to Ryan?
I think it's fairly specific to Ryan. I'd go with cache, but yeah, the cache.
Well, it's a French word, and they pronounce it cache.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, I don't know. It's an interesting one, and I think I don't know if it's still up anywhere. There was a little Easter egg that was edited into the Solution Architect Pro course a couple of years ago, where Scott Pletcher was doing a thing on, like, you know, here's how ElastiCache works. And then there's a little thing of, like, Ryan spinning around in his chair, like, I'm sorry, it's cache. If anyone has seen that, shout out to you, true original guru there.
Nice.
The one that got me was Sao Paulo.
Yeah. So I'm curious, though, as you know, we do love a bit of swag. If you're a cloud guru, do you have the orange Crocs, or are those just reserved for the guys when they're at the summit?
Oh, so I don't have any of those. What do I have? I've got a couple of orange shirts somewhere, which again are terrible for anything except conferences. I mean, bright shirts are great for conferences if you're there for that. Otherwise, I've got so much A-Clad Guru swag sitting somewhere. I wish I had some of that. Like, I've got all my AWS merch sitting everywhere, like this lovely little cup. Woo!
Nice.
We're talking about our merch before as well, but yeah, I don't have any A-Clad Guru merch around. I need to organize something like that.
See, I aspire to those orange Crocs. That's like the swag holy grail for me. But
not the HashiCorp socks.
I've already got the HashiCorp socks. Yeah.
Or the Red Hat fedora.
Yeah, I don't have the orange Crocs. So
what about the Datadog shirts? They are so good. They're very comfy.
He's got some of them, haven't you?
I've got loads of Datadog shirts. Yeah, everyone raves about the Datadog shirts. I think you used to get them. We're a Datadog partner, and I think if you completed the sales professional training, they sent you a T-shirt. And I had to keep doing that every year, renewing it. So I just kept getting Datadog T-shirts, which is great.
There we go.
I only really wear swag these days, so
it's about half my wardrobe now.
Yeah, and so, absolutely.
Bring us on the AWS swag review. Cheers.
Anyway, we're not here to talk about AWS or Cloud Guru or any swag, really. We are here to talk about AWS news. Regular listeners to the podcast will know that once a week I collate a list of AWS news, which I share via my weekly AWS News Roundup newsletter. And then John and I pick a set of the articles from the newsletter that we'd like to talk about with our guests. So we have such a selection of articles this week. And the first one, it's a mini article, really, more of an announcement about some updates to CloudFormation. Now one can experience up to 40% faster stack creation with AWS CloudFormation. So this got quite a lot of airtime last week. Is it something you're excited about, John?
Oh, yeah, Cloud9, absolutely, which not the IDE. I'm very happy about this. I saw the new status. So new status come out, this configuration complete, waiting for eventual consistency. And I saw that when I was playing around with this AI kind of summarization transcription thing that we're now doing on this podcast. And I saw that new status, went, oh, that's cool, that's new. Because then all of a sudden it was doing things that it would have sat there and waited. So the point is, it will, excuse me, I'm seriously struggling here. The point is, a number of things that CloudFormation will create are eventually consistent. So it was in the, give me an RDS database, and then it will sit there for 10 minutes going, okay, I've done that, it's not ready yet, even though it doesn't really have to do anything. So this means that it can go off and start to provision things based on top of that that need it to exist but don't need it to be ready just yet. So it allows for more parallelization. Put my teeth in.
What are your thoughts on this one, Stephen? Is it exciting news for you?
I mean, it's definitely interesting, and it's one of those things where AWS have just found something that's like, hey, this is something we can just add in a little bit more intelligence to the system, and it makes it a whole hell of a lot smarter as a result. The interesting thing for me was when I first read this, and it's like, stabilization, I don't know if I've heard of that. And I eventually remembered, like, I'd come across this a couple of years ago with some CloudFormation work I was doing. But it's one of those things, like, it's a stage that's existed in CloudFormation for a very long time, but you've almost never see anything about it. And the fact of how it works with the optimistic stabilization as well, where, it'll try and create a resource as soon as possible. If it works, cool, no problem. If it doesn't work, I guess it can't work just yet. We'll wait until the stabilization is done, then we'll try it. So the fact it's nice and automatic is nice. And likewise, one of the things that, again, it's a clever little piece of engineering in it. The fact that if you're just using implicit dependencies, it will just, do as fast as possible. If you have an explicit dependency, like, depends on something, then it will be very specific, like, no, we wait until stabilization is done. So it knows when to be cautious, and it knows when to be a little bit more optimistic about it. So I thought it was really interesting. And yeah, again, if it makes CloudFormation faster, that's a win for me.
Up to 40% faster, that's quite a bold claim. So sounds.
Yeah, cool. I've no idea how you'd come up with that metric, but subjectively it is quicker.
Based on this stack that we've put together that works in this very specific way, it's like, about 42-38% repeatable. Yeah, 40%. There we go. 40% faster CloudFormation. Excellent. So, yeah.
Get the marketing people involved. I have to say that I do love the term optimistic stabilization. It's just something quite quite nice about that. So I like to think of myself as an optimist. So that rings true with me.
There's all sorts of ists that I could call you, but none of them are safe for the podcast.
Yeah, yeah, you can leave that till after we hit the stop button. On that note,
optimistic and stable. Would you put those two together?
I wouldn't class myself as stable. No, I class myself as optimistic, but definitely unstable. So I could do with a bit of optimistic stabilization in my life, to be honest. But anyway, on that note, let's move along to our second article for this week, which is another new feature announcement. And this one's about AWS Backup. And AWS Backup now supports restore testing for Amazon Elastic Block Store Snapshots Archive. So that's EBS Snapshots Archive. So, of course, AWS Backup, something that we're regularly using with our customers. John, what are your thoughts on this new feature?
Well, this is nice. Right, a couple of definitions in case people are unaware. So AWS Backup, managed backup service, brilliant. We love it. It's a great way of centralizing backups, and you can do policies at the organization level, which, again, love them because I can just sort of go, here's how you do backups, stamp, and it just does them. Brilliant. Backup restore testing is a new-ish feature brought out, I want to say reInvent last year, tail end last year, that sort of time, whereby you can automate the restore of a backup to prove that it actually does restore, which is a thing that was kind of missing. And as part of our product discussions internally, we sort of trying to work out how can we do this. I could build a step function, a load of lambdas, and then you've got to tear it down again, and maybe you've got to wait for customers to test it, so on and so on. And then, as is ever the way, start talking about or start building a way to solve a problem, and AWS eventually does it for you. Brilliant. So that's what that is. Restoring from archive, now that's interesting, because some products, that's the word, in AWS Backup, some services support going to cold storage, and EBS is one of them. What does that mean? That means that after you've held it for 30 days, for argument's sake, you can move your backups to cold storage, and then they're cheaper. But you can't get to them quite so quickly, effectively, much like Glacier and that kind of thing with S3, same sort of concept. Now, being able to do a restore test directly from archive, directly from cold storage, is quite interesting because you don't have to come up with some sort of process to bring it out of cold storage into warm storage and then do your testing with it. So you can do your testing based on an older backup, or more interestingly, you can send your backups to cold storage much faster and still restore test on them and save yourself some money. So we like this.
What are your thoughts on this one, Stephen? Is it relevant in your world?
I mean, it's interesting because it was one of the ones that came out with reInvent. And for me, it was one of the ones that I looked at and kind of said, hey, something that's not generative AI that's actually really awesome, cool, and like really practical to businesses. Oh, I got the
fireworks for that one. Yeah.
There we go. But yeah, it was really interesting because it is just something that, again, if you're using AWS Backup, it makes perfect sense. And it's interesting if we look at the need for it as well. A lot of people, I think, sometimes assume that in cloud, it's like, you know, we're not dealing with magnetic tapes anymore. You don't need to test your backups. And it's like, you don't need to test your backups until you've needed to test your backups. And now you realize, oh crap, we should have tested our backups. And especially like, given that, you know, organizations have these longer retention periods, like, you know, in Australia under things like the Corporations Act, everything else, like, you know, you really want to be keeping your stuff for at least 7 years. So if you can go back and say, hey, let's just, you know, make sure we're testing our stuff over the, you know, these longer periods of time. It's like, hey, 4 years ago, our server, our backups, they're still fine. It's just that other little thing. It's just one more of those little things. It's just like, hey, we can feel confident that our records are safe and that no one's going to get fired, which is always a good thing. What's the first thing when you go into any organization and, you know, in an operations role, you check to make sure the backups are working. And if we've got something, again, this feature makes it great to test it. The fact we can use it with our EBS snapshots now in the archive, that is absolutely brilliant.
Yeah, I think it's a good point that we're no longer on tapes. And, you know, testing that the backups are there and that they work is one thing. But I guess you're also testing for how long is it actually going to take me to recover from a backup? Because it's one thing to know you've got a backup. But, you know, if you've got SLAs or SLOs around your application, for example, are you confident that you can meet those SLAs, SLOs, you know, with the time it's going to take you to restore your data and get your application back up and running? So I think, you know, testing these days is less about, is it actually there and can I use it? It's as much about, can I use it and how long is it going to take me to use it? How long is it going to take me to get back into production? So,
yeah. Are you going to find those acronyms for the listeners, Carl? I know you
SLAs
like
SLAs and SLOs. Yes, service level agreements and service level objectives, I believe. Yeah, SLOs is from the Site Reliability Engineering Handbook, which I've got here, and I really didn't get very far through it because I found it quite hard going. You can see where the bookmark is on that book. That's, that's right near the start, and I think I started reading it about 3 years ago. So, yeah, it's quite – there's the book if you want to know more about SLOs, Site Reliability Engineering. But
well, that sounds like a beautiful way to go to sleep at night.
It's definitely – it's soporific, absolutely. It, it definitely helped me go
to sleep. We just get an ASMR – sort of ASMR artist to record it for you, and then you can nod off to the soothing sounds of –
absolutely.
There we go.
Anyway, on that note, let's move along. We have, of course, got an article about generative AI, which, you know, what AWS News Podcast, self-respecting AWS News Podcast, is running at the moment without talking about generative AI.
Self-respecting is a bit generous.
Well, yeah. But it is the latest buzzword, and it is what everybody's talking about. So this particular article is an article from the AWS News blog announcing that Anthropic Claude 3 Haiku model is now available on Amazon Bedrock. So there's a number of Claude models available through Bedrock already, as I understand it. And John, I think you've been using one of them in your exploits with AI recently. But what's different about this particular model and the Claude 3 Haiku model?
It's specifically designed for haikus. It's not, but, you know. That's what when I was first playing with things, I'd managed to get ChatGPT to write fairly competent haikus and thought, okay, that's cool. Moving on with my life. And now they've named it after it. So, okay, nice. There's a nice little graph as you go down. And I know you like a graph. There's a nice little graph as you go down the article that overlays intelligence versus cost. Now, intelligence is an interesting word for it, but I'd call it, you know, capability personally, because I don't think it's intelligent. But, you know, how the quality of the outputs versus how much it's going to cost. And there's this nice little graph where they've got Claude 3, Haiku, Sonnet, and Opus, which are an interesting set of things to name things. You've got a Japanese sort of poem and then a very long form sort of poem, and then opus, I don't actually know what that means, if I'm honest. Like, a magnum opus is your best thing, your biggest thing, but I don't know if you can use opus as a word by itself. I don't speak enough Latin. But the idea is haiku is the cheapest and the least intelligent, but it's still more intelligent than the previous versions. And then you got sonnet and then opus, and, you know, you pay more, you get more, which is kind of logical. But now that Claude 3 Haiku is on Bedrock, you can start playing with it on Bedrock, which is great, but only in certain very specific regions because it's not available everywhere, much like most of Bedrock.
And which model were you using? Sonnet recently when you were playing?
No, that? we were using Claude V2, so not even a V3.
Yeah.
And honestly, I'll talk about this when I eventually blog about this, because I've got to crank as much content as I can out of a couple of days of work. Was I picked it because the things I was building on had used it, and they'd used it because I think of the input limitations. It had a very high number of tokens that you can give it. And if you look at something like the various Titan models, they have a very smaller number of tokens. And what we do is we're going to upload the full transcript of this, which is 10,000 words, easy, probably more. So we need a very high token count so we can actually run through it. Whether Claude 3 is going to be any better, I don't know. It will be more expensive than Claude 2, I should think, though.
What are your thoughts on this one, Stephen? Have you been playing around with Bedrock and AI?
I mean, as much as generative AI is the latest hype thing, I do like a good, fun hype piece. And this is, again, generative AI. I'm someone who is a great big detractor of blockchain because it was a, you know, solution looking for a problem. Generative AI, at least you can, you know, you have immediately obvious problems that you can do stuff with. So yeah, look, I've been ferreting around in this a little bit. Interestingly, I did have a bit of a look into the Claude V3 models. All of them now have, so Claude V2 had a 100,000 context window. For Claude V3, 200,000 context window. So twice the input size, which again is pretty good. The stats, and again, like, there's a blog from Anthropic which goes into this in a little bit more detail. Again, they're going to have chosen the best stats to represent stuff. The way it looks with Haiku, and again, this is kind of like the lower tier of the three, this one is still better than GPT 3.5, so it's still doing pretty well, but not quite as good as GPT-4. The big claim that they're kind of resting everything on with the Claude 3 series is that Claude 3 Opus is supposed to be better in pretty much every respect than GPT-4, which is like, that's a big sort of thing that they're claiming. And again, they've, you know, said, like, based on the Hella swag, based on the MMLU, all these, like, you know, nice benchmarks, it's like, it scores really well. And it's like, yes, but again, like, they've chosen very certain things there, and all of them are doing better than Claude 2, which is, you know, again, it's improving. Interestingly, on the cost front, for Claude 3 Haiku, which again is not quite as smart as Claude 2 itself, it's only about, what is it, 3% of the cost. I did a calculation, it's like incredibly cheap to run Claude 3 Haiku, even for Opus, which is going to be a bit more. It's only about twice the cost of, you know, Claude 2 at the moment. So the costs that they're getting for this is actually quite interesting, because the, you know, cost versus capability, as you've said, I don't think intelligence is the right word. The cost is actually quite well there. So yeah, look, I mean, it's very much worth checking out the Anthropic blog for anyone who wants to look at this. I did notice something though, and I'm going to put a bit of a punt on this. So when they released Sonnet, they did that on March 5th, and Haiku came out on March 14th. I'm going to predict Opus is either going to come out on either Friday this week or Monday next week. Like, if they're wanting to keep a cadence and a bit of a thing to that, I'm going to put a little pin in that for now. We'll see. Again, it kind of makes sense. They've released the mid-range model, you know, like, that makes sense. They've released the cheap model. Ooh, fast and exciting. The really big one is still up there. When's it going to come? So again, we'll see how that looks. It's interesting.
I want to know when Claude Limerick's coming out.
I mean, St. Patrick's Day is just gone. So.
Yeah, they missed that boat. They have to keep that one in the bank for next year, perhaps. But yeah.
I mean, as long as it's generating safe for work limericks, right?
I was actually in the pub with a load of Irish people yesterday. I left them to it. Let's not go down that route. On that note, let's skip on to our next article for this week, which is a post on dev.2 from an AWS hero, Yan Kui. And it's all about when to use step functions versus doing it all in a Lambda function. So, John, serverless community builder. Mm. I assume you picked this one because you want to talk about serverless. So, and yeah, obviously you've been playing a lot with both Lambda functions and step functions recently with the work that you've been doing, both for customers and for ourselves. So how do you decide when to use step functions versus a great big Lambda function?
So there's sort of two schools of thought here. And there's kind of two main types of Lambdas that you see. One of them is a function, it's a microservice, it's a micro Lambda, it's a single purpose Lambda. It gets one type of input, does one thing, spits it out the other end. It's basically a script in fancy clothes. Cool. The other type is called a Lambda Lith, which is a brilliant term, obviously monolith in Lambda, where it's doing loads and loads and loads of things, and it could have loads of different types of inputs, and it handles them, and it's much more like a traditional monolithic application. How do you kind of reconcile those? Well, you sort of don't. It's kind of one or the other. Where do step functions come in? Well, step functions aren't particularly useful for Lambda liths. They're very useful for single purpose Lambdas. So when do you use step functions? Well, it depends. Okay. I like step functions. I like putting as much things as I can in a step function, but they're not that easy to test. They're getting better. And Jan says this in the article, they're not that easy to test. But the test state API is helping with that. Up until fairly recently, how did you test it? Well, you could use step functions local, and that was sort of testing your flows, but not your inputs, not your outputs, anything like that. And that's not actually all that useful. And the only other way was you run it in the console and see what it does. Or you wrap it in a Lambda and check the inputs and the outputs. And you could kind of do an integration test, but that was about your lot. And I know that really annoys traditional developers and devs that have been doing this for 30 years and go, I need a framework, I need this, I need that. And it's, you know, it's a pain. Right. So Jan has a number of theories on this, a number of, you know, when should you do it, when should you not do it. I lean a little bit more towards use step functions more than lambdas, and that's mostly because there's a lot less code to write when you're doing things. And I think the trade-off of they're a bit harder to test is worth it, because if you look at, there's a few things that we've been to. So a chap from the Lego group, Lee Priest, did a talk on this at the London Summit last year, and that was very good. And the majority of their VIP order workflow, something like that, is done in step functions. And there's an awful lot of it just grabs things using native step function calls and does it in the step function. There's no lambda under the covers. It's just grabbing things using the Dynamo provider, and it's doing things. And it's that's great. Brilliant. There's a lot less code for you to write. It's a lot more managed. Once it's working, it's just going to work because it's doing things in a very repeatable sort of way. But lambda is a lot cheaper. It just is, regardless of the type. Lambda can be a lot cheaper. If you go with a standard step function, you pay per thousand transitions. And if it's being called a lot, it gets very, very pricey, very spendy, very quickly. Express ones are a lot cheaper, but they're a lot harder to kind of model because it's the amount of data and how much is running. And it's just kind of finger in the wind how much it's going to cost. I don't know. We'll suck it and see. So if you've got a medium-sized task that you're not sure whether it's worth splitting and spending the dev time splitting it down, or just slap your existing code into a lambda, okay, that'll work, then it's kind of a bit less clear. But, I mean, yeah, I've rambled for a good couple of minutes. Read the article. Jan explains it a lot better than I can. He's a hero for a reason.
And what about you, Stephen? Can you explain it better than John?
I mean, Jan is one of the smartest people in all of serverless. Like, and not just because he's genuinely smarter, but because he spends so much time building this stuff. He just, like, he knows it because he's seen it and tried it and tested it to death. Yeah, look, and one of the challenges with things like step functions is the fact that if you want to test it, your option is basically down to, like, well, you can mock things, and mocking is not good testing, right? It's just, it's still a bit of a challenge. But that said, I would still prefer step functions almost any day of the week. When it comes to serverless in AWS, people tend to either go Lambda, they go Event Bridge, or they go step functions. I am very much in the step functions camp. Like, it is my favorite service of things, just being like, it is so nice to use, and it is so nice to get everything working just so right. The interesting thing for me with this as well is one thing that, you know, kind of gets highlighted here is the role of step functions express, because traditionally when we've looked at it, we've kind of said, you know, you either use Lambda or you use step function standard, and step function standard is, like, very clearly good for so many things. Step functions express kind of starts to blur those lines a little bit, where you kind of enter a realm where you can get the power of step functions, but you leverage some of the things, like, you know, if you're running something that's very quick, you know, doesn't take a lot of time, you know, you can have as many state transitions as you want, as long as it's fast, it doesn't matter. In fact, I have a bit of a theory. So last year there was that whole Prime Video, you know, like, thing. Yeah. Prime, you know, Video couldn't make, you know, serverless work, so therefore serverless is dead. I seriously believe, like, from everything that I read on that, I believe that predated Step Functions Express being a thing. And from everything I read, I believe if you used Step Functions Express for that, you could get it working very, very nicely. Which, again, that's probably why Amazon built it. The interesting thing as well is coming in June, I think it was June, it was about mid last year, Step Functions released also their ability to now do versioning and aliases as well, which means you can actually get a lot more control of your step functions as well. And if you're treating step functions as, I go into the console, I click around and it's like, there's my business process. Lovely. It's a little fragile. And again, it's a little bit questionable. If you're using, like, the visual tools to build it, no problem. But if you're deploying it with your infrastructure as code tools, you're able to kind of plan out how you're deploying it. You're able to control your deployment processes, that sort of thing. To me, step functions are going to win most of the time. Again, if you're looking at something very, very basic, you know, Lambda functions, very straightforward. And you can refactor a Lambda function back into a step function. It's just a little trickier if you go too far down that path. But for me, by and large, I'm going to go for the step functions. And again, nice. I could ramble on that, but I'm not going to. Who would have thought, like, text can be opinionated about stuff?
Absolutely. Okay, on that note, let's skip along to our final article for this week. And this is actually a little bit of local news for you, Stephen, being in your local city. So Amazon have just announced the first builder studio down under in Melbourne. I think it's the first builder studio outside of mainland US, I believe. Or did we report on another one that was...
I've got a feeling there's one in South Africa, weirdly. Mm, they've propped up in weird places. Mm. Melbourne's not weird, but it's not the sort of... you think London, you think Berlin, Munich, Amsterdam, Lisbon, maybe. You don't think, I don't know where we're going to put our second one outside of the States. Melbourne. Okay.
It's a little center. Like, yeah. No, and it's interesting. Like, and you say local news, which is all the more interesting because we were having a quick chat about this before we started recording. So the first I found out about the Builder Studio, like, again, people kind of assumed, like, well, you're in the know with AWS. You know, you would have seen something about this. Maybe you weren't invited. The first thing I heard about this was from a friend who was actually watching, I think it was like some kind of news channel, and they were like, hey, you know, like there was, you know, a new AWS thing open today, you know, in the city. Isn't this cool? You know, have you seen much about this? And it's like, what AWS thing? Builder Studio? What's this? Oh, interesting. And sure enough, I go and ask some AWS staff and they're like, oh yeah, we found out about that on the news today too. So it's like, okay. So and again,
Melbourne's best kept secret.
Well, it's one of those things they build. It's like, you know, we had like a developers launch thing and it's like, cool, where were the developers? But again, like they launched it with their big innovation partner down here, which was V2 Digital, who's like a very, you know, big up and coming local consultancy. And like their people are really, really good at what they do. One of the interesting things is for anyone who's in the Melbourne area and looking to attend, the team behind V2 Digital, they do have a meetup that they're going to be hosting there on the 30th of April, I do believe, at the end of April. So if you go on meetup.com and look for AWS Builders After Dark Melbourne, you'll be able to find some details on that. I can probably send a link through in the show notes or something like that. But yeah, it's going to be really interesting. Looks like a really cool space. Again, it's kind of a space where they can demonstrate all kinds of, you know, cooler technology, all kinds of, you know, the innovative prototype-y type stuff that doesn't just live on a laptop, which, you know, again, I mean, I can look at that and say, is this useful or is this just, you know, a bunch of fancy toys in one place? It's like, I don't know. At the same time, I do want to go see the fancy toys. Like, I can't deny that. So, yeah, I mean, for me, I'll be looking forward to going to see it as soon as that comes around. And if anyone wants to go and see it, the official line they're saying is go poke your AWS account manager. So, or if you know someone at AWS like I do, go poke them. So for anyone who I know from AWS in Melbourne, I'm sorry, you're going to be getting a DM from me soon.
Let me in. Let me in to the Builder Studio.
I want shiny things. Give me shiny things.
So, John, I assume you're looking forward to the launch of the Builder Studio London at some point.
Oh, I don't know, maybe. I'm just looking at this smart factory demonstration, and it looks like they've made it out of Lego, which is cool. That's what they say.
It's kind of like they're doing like an IoT robotics thing, and like the generative AI stuff, like they've got a whole bunch of generative AI stuff there, which is like, it feels kind of like a bit of a Skunk Works type thing. Like I kind of think about like, if I was given 6 months and just told like, build crazy but cool stuff, then it's just kind of like, hey, go make a bunch of stuff like that and fit out our office, and it'd be like, yes, awesome.
I'll bring me Lego. And my soldering irons.
You don't solder Lego. You get
like a Lego machine that makes like new Lego machines. Like for me, if I was
Legoception.
If I was told like, hey, that's your job for the next 3 months, sure thing, boss, no problemo.
If only we all had the time to be so creative.
If only.
Anyway, on that note, that does bring us neatly to the end of our time for Season 3, Episode 12 of Logicast. So thank you very much, Stephen, for joining us from the other side of the globe and sharing your insights. And thank you, John, as always, for joining us from just up the road. So that was Season 3, Episode 12 of Logicast, the AWS News podcast brought to you by Logicarta. Thank you very much for listening. If you enjoyed it, tell your friends. If you want to see what we look like when we're talking to you, you can find us on YouTube, or you you can download us from all major podcast distribution platforms. We'll be back next week with another episode of Logicast for you. So until then, thanks for listening. See you again next time.
Make sure to tune in to find out what's happening with John.